Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another edition we have here of Crime and Science Radio, of course, hosted by Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is called Research, Education, and the Future of Forensic Science, an interview with Dr. Catherine A. Roberts, Director of CSULA Graduate Program in Criminal Logistics. And I never know what that is, but this is going to be fascinating because talk to her a little bit off the air, and you're going to be in such a treat. So without any further ado, let's go right now to our hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome, everyone. I'm really happy to have Dr. Catherine Roberts with us. Today, she's the director of the California State University Los Angeles Graduate Program in Criminalistics, and she's also served as the director of the Master's of Science degree for that program there since 2002, and she played a really big role in the university's accreditation with a tough group to get accredited by, and that's the Forensic Science Education Program's Accreditation Commission, or FEPAC, which is really a difficult accreditation to reach, so she was successful with that. So we're happy to have her here. She's also a major researcher in forensic science. We'll talk to her about her research, and someone who's working on forensic science at a national level also is part of the Technical Working Group for Education and Training in Forensic Science. So welcome to the program, and it's good to have you here, Kim.
Thank you. Thank you, Jan. Thank you.
Well, tell us about your background. I think if people listen here too, they'll realize, like they used to say in the old Western, you're not from around here, are you? So tell us about your background.
Okay, yeah. So, no, I'm not. I grew up in the United Kingdom. I'm from a small town in Wales where everybody pretty much knows each other, which is a blessing. Sometimes not a blessing. this year actually is I was thinking about this earlier, but this actually is a landmark year for me because I've now lived in the United States for as long as I lived in Wales. I was the first person in my family to go to university. I enrolled as a chemistry major in King's College, which is part of the University of London. And after graduating with my undergraduate degree, I pretty much took a year off to travel and work in Europe before deciding what to do with my life.
Well, what brought you to forensic science? What lit that fire in you, and what did you do to pursue that calling?
I think probably looking back, it was my early high school years. I remember speaking with a college mentor, advisor for career, and I remember being pretty adamant and her sharing with me that I shouldn't really be putting all my eggs in one basket. So that kind of tells me that I was probably convinced at that early age that I was going to be involved in forensic science in some capacity. So it's interesting, in the United Kingdom, at least when I went to high school, we were expected to select our advanced study subjects at a really early age. So by the age of 14, I actually selected this science option route. So it was really no looking back. I really enjoyed chemistry. I was an avid reader of crime and mystery books. Yeah, it didn't really matter whether it was fact or fiction. I really was absorbed with it. It seemed to me at the time that forensic science seemed the perfect combination. I recall watching the show Quincy, for example. You know, that was obviously pre-CSI in my day, of course. In King's, I actually joined the Sherlock Holmes Society. I don't know if you're familiar with that society, but It's a fairly small group of individuals that read various books that Arthur Conan Doyle wrote, and then you get really absorbed in the stories, go to the locations that were alluded to in the books in London, and really had a tremendous time as part of that group. After graduating, I took another 6 months off to travel. This time I went to the United States. I then returned to graduate school in Scotland. The program in Scotland actually required a practicum. It was a two-year program that required a practicum internship. And so during my travels in the United States, I had met a number of contacts in New York, including some individuals that familiarized myself with the program at John Jay College. They had a master's program, a PhD program at the time. And so I used that contact later on while I was in the graduate program to ask my mentor in Glasgow in Scotland, did he have any contacts at John Jay so I could conduct this internship. I actually had some friends in New York I could stay with, which definitely made it cost effective because there's no way I'd had the money to stay in New York at that time. Well, I don't know if I still do, but so basically I did my internship with a professor in New York by the name of Professor Peter DeForest. He's nationally, internationally known for his work in trace evidence. I worked on an NIJ-funded research project at John Jay for 6 months. We were working on a project at the time called supercritical chromatography, and we were trying to characterize different types of trace evidence. We had some success, but the instrumentation now has improved remarkably from those days. So I graduated with my master's degree. I was back in Wales, and I was considering some employment offers. And I just out of the blue, I received this call from Dr. DeForest, and he asked me if I was interested in becoming his permanent research assistant on the NIJ grant. His assistant at the time had accepted a position at the New York Medical Examiner's Office, and I'd been trained for 6 months, so I told him I needed a few days to think about it, talked to my parents, and a couple of days later I called him and I said, yeah, sure, yeah, I'll take it. And so that kind of started my passion for trace evidence. He was an incredible mentor to me, Professor DeForest. A year later, I was accepted to the doctoral program. They were one of the few PhD programs in forensic science / criminalistics at the time. So I was offered a teaching assistant, so I worked with Dr. DeForest for 5 years. He also had a private practice, a forensic consulting practice, so I worked periodically to supplement my income and pay my way through the PhD program that way. I've remained in touch with him ever since. In fact, we recently submitted an article together to the Journal of Forensic Sciences on an antemortem postmortem root band study that you may hear from a little bit from now if you ask me questions related to that. So I think that's kind of in a nutshell why I became interested in forensic science.
Well, not only that, is how you pursued it. I mean, that's a great answer. I know,
yeah.
Jan and I get asked all the time, if I want to get into the forensic world, what do I need to do? Well, it takes an interest, a commitment, a focus, a dedication,
yeah,
and a lot of hard work,
yeah,
because you can't just say, well, I want to do it, and then next week you do. I think that's a wonderful answer. So after all of that, that little stuff, how did you end up at Cal State LA, which is an incredible program that we're so proud of out here?
I actually saw an advertisement for an assistant professor position at Cal State LA while I was attending one of the American Academy of Forensic Science meetings. I don't recall where the location was, but I decided to apply. I'd actually finished my coursework in the PhD program, so I thought this would be timely to apply for a position. But I hadn't finished my doctoral work, my dissertation. So I interviewed, I was offered the position, and I basically accepted it. It's the one and only interview I've ever had except for this one. what I was actually considering is by accepting the position, I was also able to complete my dissertation here in California, because at the time I was doing some preliminary research on mitochondrial DNA. I kind of switched to the biology world for a little bit because I knew that at that time that DNA was about to explode. But I do, in my defense, say at least I was analyzing hairs. So I didn't deviate too much from trace evidence. I was actually evaluating this condition in hairs called heteroplasmy, which we've resolved now. And at the time, it was an unknown condition, and it could have caused issues in terms of false interpretations. But I was using a linear array assay method that at the time was under development at Roche Molecular Systems that are based in Alameda. And that, the fact that I was in California allowed me to travel back and to from L.A. to the San Francisco Bay Area several times. And so I was able to complete my dissertation several years after I'd accepted my position at Cal State while I was still an assistant professor. I've actually been at Cal State LA now for over 18 years. I'm going into my 19th year as I was awarded full professor, I think, 8 years ago. So, yeah, 18 years, and I wonder where the time's gone.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Sangiovese Forensic Science Program is unusual in that a major regional crime lab is housed actually on the campus. And those crime labs are of two huge agencies, the LAPD and the LA Sheriff's Department labs are part of the Hertzberg-Davis Center there. So how does your program at CSULA interact with those agencies?
Well, I mean, there are several ways that we interact. Perhaps if I could give you some probably more specific examples here. Perhaps a good example might be that we have a formal internship program for our graduate students with LAPD. This is typically an internship that occurs over a summer period when we're not hosting classes. The graduate students will be assigned some type of validation project that the LAPD is interested in, across different disciplines, really. So typically, 5 to 6 of our graduate students each year will work with the agencies. It's really invaluable. It's invaluable for the agency. I know that they find it very rewarding. The students do. We find that the students, for example, they'll leave us after their first year, and they almost grow up in their internship during the summer, because when we get them in their second year, it just seems so much more mature. You know, they've spent this time in the lab, and they get the opportunity, for example, to go on ride-alongs if it's applicable to the section. They get to go to observe criminalists in court, and the LAPD get to see potentially if somebody is a good future employee too, rather than just the typical 20-minute interview that they get. So that's one way. And they're unpaid, but we do give the students elective credit for the internship, so they get some reward academically. The mentors in the lab will also evaluate the students, so they get good feedback in terms of what they need to improve on, what will help them in terms of applying for positions. Other ways, other than the internships, we collaborate with research projects. Often I'll ask one of the criminalists if they want to be a consultant on the grant. I ask them to review the grants to see if I'm being too academic, whether there's a, you know, there are really practical applications to this. The LAPD and LA Sheriff Administration have been really wonderful by providing letters of recommendation. I know that looks very favorable to NIJ and NSF too, getting these letters of support. Other ways, we have, you know, this quarter alone, I've had a couple of guest lecturers in my class. I teach this quarter, and I've had a couple of former students present to the students on this area of uncertainty of measurement now that labs have to be mindful of. So they've had uncertainty of measurement in firearms, uncertainty of measurement in blood alcohol, and it just gives the students that sort of reinforcement that what they're learning in the classroom is also applicable to the field. Mm-hmm. We recruit practitioners as part-time faculty, again, giving that balance to our curriculum in terms of theory and practice. LAPD get to use our classrooms for training purposes, so it kind of it's a quid pro quo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the other thing I wanted to sort of emphasize, the facility itself is really impressive. I think it's a major attraction to students who are applying to our grad program. It looks grandiose. You know, it looks like somewhere you'd want to go to school and learn how to become a forensic scientist. So, I mean, I'm sure there are other things I'm overlooking here ways in which we interact, but, you know, we just get along wonderfully, all three of us, all three agencies.
I have seen that when I was there, and in fact, I want to mention that you and I met through the California Forensic Science Institute, of which you are now the interim program director, which is just part of this sort of wonderful outreach that combines not just the university and those two departments, but departments throughout Southern California who previously had to go to Northern California for training because that's where the state lab was located. So it's changed the opportunities for the police departments throughout the region. As well, so it's really a fantastic program. But you mentioned something that I wanted to pursue. Is there a divide between academic forensic science and forensic science as it is practiced across the U.S., and how is CSULA bridging that divide?
Let's see. Well, I don't know if the divide is really any greater than academia and practice in any other profession, if I'm being perfectly honest. I think that there are some new technologies that academic programs are exploring that I think may be of future interest to practitioners. But in terms of the divide, I think it's important to make the distinction that academic programs and operational labs do have different objectives, I mean, different primary objectives. I think when we consider our academic program, what we're doing is providing a foundation for the discipline, you know, and say an understanding of underlying theory, how to approach problems, things like critical thinking skills. And of course, because we're a graduate program, we conduct research as well. We're not interested in the training per se for a particular agency, whereas I think the practitioner focus is on training and preparation for casework. So very few forensic science labs have a dedicated research program. So the way that you might sort of consider Hertzberg-Davis, sort of our vision is that we as academics, we occupy the second floor of Hertzberg-Davis. So on the second floor, we're conducting the research. We're demonstrating the results of the research to the practitioners. And then these practitioners are above us and below us on the third, fourth, fifth floor, and to some degree on the floor below us. They obviously want to see the benefits of adopting, say, new methods or instrumentation before making a decision as to whether they should adopt it. You know, it isn't a trivial decision given the resources that the laboratories have to commit in terms of, say, the amount of time they have to do in validating new methods, you know, in order to actually use them or implement them into casework. So that we're trying to bridge that divide, I guess, in the sense that our research collaborations and our internship programs will help expose these new approaches to the agencies. I think maybe a couple of examples that come to mind on projects our students have worked on recently, there's a fairly small validation study, but one of the concerns that one of the agencies had, it's actually not the LAPD or LA Sheriff in this case, it's another agency that we have an internship program with, but if you one of the agencies had a concern that when, for example, someone deposits their fingerprints at a crime scene, you know, given the sensitivity now of touch DNA, they were concerned that when their fingerprint technicians go to process those latent prints, that the bristles on their fingerprint brush would actually pick up some touch DNA so that when they reuse those brushes for another case, they're actually going to cross-contaminate touch DNA. if that makes sense. So they wanted to sort of determine whether, you know, they didn't have all the time in the world to do a research project on this. So one of our graduate students conducted a research project where they were able to process the bristles and take it all the way through DNA typing. And it turns out that there were no concerns in the end, that it wasn't sensitive enough across multiple samples to cross-contaminate. They were getting clean profiles where, you know, one single source profiles. And I didn't realize this at the time, but fingerprint technicians are very protective of their brushes. They didn't want to have to dispose their brushes because they have this notion of a lucky brush. You know, it's done well in the past. You know, it's little things like that that you don't really consider. So they were happy that they didn't have to change their protocol, but they just don't have the time to do a lot of these research projects. Another one that we're working on with LAPD currently, LAPD were interested in validating their alternate light source, infrared alternate light source system that comes with a camera in order to visualize latent blood stains at a crime scene. These are perhaps blood stains that are on dark objects and the blood isn't readily visible. So for your listeners, I'm sure they're aware that if you take infrared light and you shine it onto blood, the blood actually absorbs the light and it creates a dark image if you convert it to a black and white format, whereas the background ideally would reflect that light. So you end up with this black and white image on your camera or your photograph, your final digital photograph, that is a dark area where the stain is and a light area in the surrounding areas. It doesn't always work. I mean, there were some examples of some unsuccessful fabrics that the blood was deposited on, but it's certainly helping in contrast enhancement, and so now the LAPD are using that method when they go to a crime scene in order to detect blood stains. So, you know, and many of these projects I'm referring to, I should mention, many of our former students who now work for the agencies are actually paying it forward to some extent because they're actually serving as the mentors for our current students, and that's just so wonderful. So that's just a couple of examples for you of, I think, how we're at least attempting to bridge the divide in terms of demonstrating these new projects.
Fascinating. Fascinating stuff. Since we're talking about research, what do you see the new technologies, what's being worked on at Cal State and in other places, and what do you see on the horizon? Are there some cool stuff coming down the pike?
Let's see. So here at Cal State, I probably should say that most of the research that my colleagues do at Cal State LA you would consider them more within the accepted disciplines, like the forensic chemistry and forensic biology disciplines. I say that because they're safe in the sense that a lot of the research that we do, we can qualify and quantify our data. So we have sort of objective instruments to do that. So an example that comes to mind is a recent project that we started with a company called Implan. They're actually based in the Thousand Oaks, actually. They developed this instrument called a nanophotometer, and it's an ultraviolet visible spectroscopy unit that we've been using to help apply to a project that we're calling the Morphine Tampering Project. This instrument, it's really, I think it fits the ideal in that it's highly sensitive. You can transport it to a crime scene. It's rather light, a couple of pounds. It's portable. It's battery operated. And actually, you can actually even operate the instrument through your smartphone. There's a Wi-Fi app. So when a student is in the lab, doing some demonstrations, they can actually through our phones, they can send me the latest data in my office. It's really neat. So the reason that we were interested in this nanophotometer for this morphine project, and you'll see, so I think the applicability given the portability and sensitivity. A couple of years ago, we were initially approached by an emergency medical technician, and they mentioned to us that there is a problem amongst emergency medical services. This is California, of course. I can't speak beyond that, but the problem that they were encountering is the theft of morphine vials that were stored on their vehicles. and they were suspecting that certain individuals were going in and substituting the morphine with something else available on the vehicle, say saline, or there were several other drugs that they could have used, like Benadryl, or I think midazolam, which is Vicet, and epinephrine. They were actually substituting it. Typically, I think they suspected for self-abuse purposes. So what we've been doing is we've been trying to work on developing a simple, quick, obviously reliable, accurate way of being able to detect whether a vial contains morphine or something that's been adulterated. It may contain residual morphine, but adulterated with other solutions. And it's been successful. We've got some technical notes that we're presenting, and we've also presented it at some local conferences. The obviously the issue isn't restricted to EMS. Obviously, it may be applicable to other professions too, particularly if there's surreptitious drug handling occurring. So we're continuing that work with the California Emergency Services. But this unit is really a potential answer to that problem, because it could be housed on the unit or it could be used for random sampling. Give you some other examples. LAPD currently is looking into a Raman spectroscopy unit, a handheld device. Talk to some of the people that are running that project. What they're attempting to do is potentially replace the way they screen drugs. The way they traditionally would screen a controlled substance is to do a wet chemical analysis, where they look for a color change when they add a drop of a particular reagent to a drug. So sometimes you're handling hazardous chemicals. They're looking at this technique called Raman spectroscopy. It's a portable unit. You can buy larger models of it to screen the drug in a way that doesn't require sample handling. And the advantage it actually provides, Raman does something that no other spectroscopy technique that I'm aware of does, is it can actually penetrate the container. So you wouldn't have to open the glass vial or the baggie. It's got software in place that can actually do mixture deconvolution too, so even if there's a cutting agent in the drug, it can still detect the controlled substance. So we're working on a similar project with Raman, but looking at ink analysis. And the difference for us is we're actually looking at attaching a microscope to the unit, so we can differentiate between very small samples of ink. A colleague of mine is looking at wound origin studies. Professor Johnson, my colleague, is our forensic biologist, and he's interested in identifying genetic markers that would distinguish different tissues. His area of interest, for example, would be if you found a blood stain in a bathroom and you were unable to do a histological analysis because the tissue perhaps is decomposed, you couldn't do a microscopical analysis and look at histology, being able to state definitively that blood originated from, say, a stab wound to the chest, as opposed to just an individual alleging that they cut their finger. So he's doing some interesting work there that explores microRNA, which is the precursor to DNA, for tissue specificity. I have lots of other projects, but I'm sure you have other questions for me.
That is amazing stuff.
And we
all love this scientific stuff, and we all get involved in it and read about it and learn about it, and a lot of people do. But it's a lot of questions have come up lately about forensic science and whether if it's really a science. Is it tried and true? Is it mumbo jumbo? Is it scientifically sound? In medicine too, where I work, they have the same questions now. But forensic science has really come under fire lately.
Mm-hmm.
Are these things warranted? Is that real, or is it really pretty sound? Maybe we're looking at it the wrong way.
I think I'd have to say I think it's unfair to just paint the whole field with such a broad critique or stroke, if you will. I think there are disciplines within forensic science that have come under scrutiny, and I think these probably fall into most notably the pattern evidence disciplines. So examples would include, say, handwriting or different forms of impression evidence. that can range from fingerprints to shoe impressions, tire, even firearms-related evidence. If you consider the signatures that they leave, impressions they leave on the cartridge case or the bullet. As far as the concerns, to give it some background context, I think for the pattern evidence disciplines, the reason that there's the concern, and I think rightly warranted to that degree, the approach that they use in these pattern discipline areas in general is they compare this known source with a question item of evidence, and it's really based on inductive reasoning. They're looking at the question item and they're comparing it to evidentiary items of, say, a known origin, and then if they see common characteristics in the pattern, they'll come up with a conclusion, and there are different conclusions that they can come up with, again, based on this subjective assessment. They can call it an identification. And there's different words for this, too, which can be confusing. An identification is sometimes called a positive identification. Other people might call it an individualization. In fact, if you look at the training across the different disciplines of pattern analysis, there are different classifications for firearms versus fingerprints versus, say, handwriting. Handwriting actually has up to, I think, 9 different conclusions. Possibly yes, possibly, you know. So it's very vague. So, you know, these conclusions, either an identification, an example here would be that someone would be willing to say that the fingerprint found at the scene is definitely from this known source, this suspect print. Another conclusion is that they simply have no information or insufficient information, so they call it sort of an inconclusive. And then there's the definitely isn't associated, which is the elimination, which is the one that's least troublesome, I guess. So, you know, when you think about, for the most part, when they measure these variables, they're looking at the pattern and they're looking at different types of characteristics. Sometimes they're class characteristics. A class characteristic for your listeners is if you're just coming up with a physical measurement or a model number. If it's a shoe impression or a tire impression, it's this make and model. Whereas an individual characteristic is this unique feature that is believed to be sort of a one of a kind type source. But they're all based on these visual observations, and you know, for that you can imagine that they're inherently subjective for that reason. So the criticism that comes in is this reliance on the empirical observation that's made and these subjective conclusions, and they get away with it, they say, because they're experienced, that they've done it several times. It's sometimes called the source attribution approach. So one other thing that I just wanted to comment here, though, before I talk about, you know, the challenges that I think this involves, is that, you know, you've got this identification, but you can't directly prove it. It's inductive logic, right? But the problem is it's been widely accepted by the forensic science community, and it's also been accepted by the courts. And the comparison doesn't involve any type of statistical method when they're comparing the pattern. So they really don't assign a level of confidence in their conclusions, just purely based on this subjective assessment. So that's where the criticism comes in. In my opinion, I think the concerns are warranted in these areas. But I do want to also catch that with, I don't have the answers either. I'm not a statistician. Because at the same time, there are these challenges. You know, if you have a trace evidence analyst who's comparing two fibers, in order to make that comparison and apply some statistical methods, you have to imagine that huge databases have to be developed. And that's really a huge investment of time and money. When you're rendering these positive identifications, the idea that this fingerprint definitely came from this source, it's interesting. I mean, again, how they'll apply statistical, enumerate or come up with numerical numbers to a pattern to demonstrate how significant that is, again, requires close work with statisticians. Forensic scientists typically don't have that kind of background. I suppose, in closing, also I think I think the how you communicate these statistical findings in courts in ways that will engage the jury is also something that I think is going to be interesting to observe. I do want to end on a positive note, though, because I don't know if you're aware of this, but this last year alone, I think in 2015, the Forensic Science Center of Excellence was established to address these very issues. So now under the guidance of NIST, or working closely with NIST, forensic scientists and statisticians are working very closely to hopefully provide these solutions. And it was very well funded. To the Department of Justice provided $20 million over 5 years to address these questions. So it is a long-term project. So I think it's you know, indication of positive future.
Well, is your group there at Cal State LA, are y'all involved in examining any of these arenas? Intimately involved in trying to standardize and make things a little better quality, a little better understanding.
So the actual working with the Center of Excellence directly, no, but indirectly we may be involved because UC Irvine are one of the awardees for the Center of Excellence. They have a really good group of statisticians there. So I've been in collaboration with one of the faculty members there, and they're interested in our forensic science projects. They have the statisticians, and we have the research projects. So I think it's a win-win. One of the projects we have in mind, for example, to start working with the Center of Excellence to address these issues is actually the controversial area of handwriting or signatures. So LAPD and LA Sheriff have approached us, my colleague and I, to assist with this signature complexity study. It's really actually very interesting. I never really thought that I would be involved in a project on handwriting with the question document section, but it's an interesting problem. So what they want to do is they want to evaluate the complexity of a signature. So we have all these signatures that we're going to be bringing in, and they have different levels. They have a low, medium, and high complexity. So the issue is, If a signature has low complexity, it's actually easy to simulate. So if the examiner fails to detect the simulation, then, of course, the opinion of the examiner isn't reliable. So they may falsely include that signature as authentic. So that's really our hypothesis that we're testing in answer to your question, Doug. We are looking at, that's an example of how we might be looking at this long-held belief that, you know, a signature is unique because we accept it as, you know, authenticating all the documents we sign. So it remains that we have no results on this study yet, but we're beginning to work with the group.
Good. That's it. You wouldn't want to look at my signature as a physician. I created a logo a long time ago, and it's never the same twice.
Really? Yeah, that's important to establish, yeah.
Plausible deniability. Okay.
Maybe I can ask you for
I didn't sign that.
I just want to... I don't know how much of all this you can talk about it at this stage of things, but I know you're also doing things with disciplines like engineering and looking at ways engineering can help set up testing and in ways that I think, I mean, I know there's a whole discipline of forensic engineering, but this is sort of that using what an engineer can set up to testing, say that may be held in forensic anthropology or in in other areas of forensic science. So that's some exciting stuff happening there.
Yeah, it is.
So how does there is some, you know, I know that some of what you're doing questions our current knowledge. I think this year we're going to be hearing an awful lot. I just let people know you're going to be hearing a lot about bite marks. Texas has decided not to admit, their Forensic Science Commission has decided not to admit bite mark evidence, and that's based to a great degree, I guess, on the work of some academic forensic science researchers at the University of Buffalo. And so I'm just wondering, you know, at the same time, you're going to have people who are pretty invested in bite marks. So are we at a time, is this kind of questioning tearing forensic science apart, or is it strengthening it?
Well, I think we have to always question, I think, our current knowledge. That's how we move forward, right? I mean, I think even if you look at the signature complexity study, I think it's been generally accepted that question document examiners feel fairly confident that they can distinguish signatures regardless of the complexity. That the same thing is happening. We have a fingerprint study also, Jan, that we're working on, where we're seeing some really interesting work. We're looking at fingerprints over time, and one of the things that we've actually noticed, I mean, if you have this sort of notion that a fingerprint is permanent, you know, aside from, say, scratches on the surface or cuts or incidental marks, or obviously if you take your fingerprint to roll it on a surface but there's some relative movement that causes distortion, I'm not really referring to that. But one of the things we've actually found with this one study on fingerprints is a previously undescribed phenomenon where it looks as if one of the ridges in the print actually shifts quite noticeably over time on certain surfaces, these non-porous surfaces. We've actually called it ridge drift because it hasn't been noted in the literature before. So we just published a paper in the Forensic Science International a couple of months ago. You know, because, of course, if a forensic examiner, you know, sees this and is unaware of this phenomenon, one could argue that would actually be a false exclusion. So we're really trying to question some of these long-standing beliefs in that respect. So that's an example of how we're questioning what we currently know. Another example is our hair study. We have a study where we're looking at the forensic literature, and for the last 20 years, the literature's reported that if you want to discriminate hairs from a living versus a deceased individual, then you look for these signs of decomposition in the hair root. But we've actually been able to replicate it in living subjects. You know, you take a plucked hair and you put it in different moist environments and then mount it, the characteristics clearly don't discriminate between whether it's antemortem and postmortem. But when I showed these hairs blindly to a criminalist not long ago, that criminalist said all these hairs look postmortem to me. So we have to question, you know, if they're using that in casework, that's going to lead to some error. So, and I think obviously we're aware of the 2009 NAS report talking about it was critical of forensic science and made it clear that we have to do this research to guide our findings and our interpretations. I think also the fact that now this Forensic Science National Commission has been established and the role of the Forensic Science Center of Excellence and the funding they've got, they've been given, I think, you know, these recent efforts, I think, only speak to strengthening forensic science. So I'm more encouraged. I think I've answered your question, but I'm not entirely sure.
No, I feel the same. I feel that this is the nature of science, is question what's gone before. It's why we're not still bleeding people.
Yeah.
You know,
I think it's
because we've questioned before what we believed, what everyone held sacred for a long time. You know, we've had, you know, science questions what's gone before.
But actually, we do still bleed people. Polycythemia, hemochromatosis. We actually do still bleed people, but not for the reasons we did before.
not every time somebody has pneumonia.
Exactly.
You know?
You don't bleed the king to death.
Yeah,
you lose
yeah,
your job.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, tell us about the California Forensic Science Institute. More about it. What is it? What has it done? How did it come about? What's it doing?
Well, I think the mission, the Forensic Science Institute was the brainchild of Barry Fisher and Rose Oche, my predecessors at Cal State. The mission really is to support, it's part of the College of Health and Human Services, which is where our program is also placed. The mission really is to support faculty, graduate student research, continuing education for practitioners, and also what's become known as the new term that we use in academia now, community engagement. So we're engaging the community in the forensic sciences. So with respect to community engagement, for example, we have these educational tours for high schoolers. We do it every first and third Friday of the month, and we get a lot of feedback in terms of how these young individuals want to become forensic scientists. And we also have summer camps. We offer week-long crime scene investigation summer camps for high school students. We usually take in about 25 to 30 students. It's co-sponsored by the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, and it's really exhausting. I'm usually used to teaching graduate students, so teaching and, you know, trying to engage with them instead of their phone is quite challenging. But they really, really are absorbed in it. They really found it very, very interesting. And, you know, their parents were telling us after the summer camp that we had this past summer, they were telling my colleague, Don Johnson, that I feel like the parents said, I finally feel like I did something right. You know, my kid wants to go to school and become a forensic scientist for the rest of their lives. And that's very rewarding when I hear that.
Absolutely.
For research, what we're doing, our big research project right now is an NSF-funded planning grant award where we're trying to establish an industry university cooperative center on our campus. And the idea here behind this IUCRC is that we're trying to encourage biotechnology companies and other industries to buy into our center. They basically pay a fee in order for us to give them that research that they'll later benefit from. What we're doing is the faculty might come up with the research projects, and then they'll approach industry to ask them, you know, how they would sort of tweak the research for their own needs. It's pre-competitive research. They would then take that research and make it competitive into a product that they would then sell to forensic agencies. So we're in the planning phase. It's actually a little bit more challenging than I thought it would be, because bringing different companies into a cooperative environment when they have proprietary concerns is a lot more challenging than I predicted a year ago. So I'm trying to encourage them that this would be pre-competitive research. But we have a number of research projects with different industries now, I think 5 or 6 different projects going on. So it's a matter of convincing them now that they put in this membership fee so that we can go forward with a Phase 1 grant, which is a 5-year grant from NSF.
It's also really incredibly interdisciplinary on the
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually called the Center for Interdisciplinary Forensic Science Research. We have the bioengineering faculty, the anthropology faculty involved, and it's meant to be cooperative in that sense that, you know, different faculty will bring in different specializations, you know, to improve the project overall. It also has to, because it's NSF funded, it has to involve graduate student research too. That's imperative for these types of projects. So they'd be funding graduate students for a year for 20 hours a week if they invest in this. And that's always important, because getting student funding is sometimes challenging.
You know, we kind of touched on this earlier, but I want you to put on your Karnak bonnet and your dust off your crystal ball. But what do you see frontiers down the road, the areas we're going to move into? What will we be able to do, say, 10 years from now that we can't do now?
So with a crystal ball, Well, actually, there's something that I think is on the horizon, possibly in the next 5 years. One of the projects that we've been working on is this old age problem of, you know, of course, we can identify a fingerprint as to its source for all intents and purposes, but one thing we can't address is the time of deposition. You know, how long what's the age of the fingerprint? How long has the fingerprint been there. So I've been working with this European group who have been doing some preliminary research on looking at different characteristics as to how we go about in a controlled environment trying to age a fingerprint. So the goal 5 to 7 years down the line is actually to develop an in-situ tool that you can take to a crime scene, scan that latent fingerprint, and using all the software deconvolution and all the statistics that have been built into the device, that you can actually come up with a window as to how long that fingerprint's been deposited. And, of course, you could make the same argument with bloodstains, too, to be able to aid them to come up with a definitive tool. Right now with bloodstains, we've done some preliminary studies, and other universities have, too. It's just it's so subject to variables that we just simply can't isolate, like humidity and temperature. You get some really good initial results, and then the temperature and the humidity factor just throw your data out of the window. So I think another area is identification of genetic markers to identify specific body fluids, because right now we're really constrained by only being able to definitively identify whether it's a blood stain or whether it's in a sexual assault case, whether it's a semen stain, but all other body fluids, we haven't found a marker that we may not possibly find in other body fluids. So I think that's something that a lot of forensic biologists are working on now, idea of body fluids using genetic markers.
Well, you know, Kevya, I have enjoyed our time here so much, and the time has flown by. I just looked up and realized that we're going to have to ask you to come back for your third interview of your life. but some maybe just because I know we have a lot of young listeners who are interested in forensic science, can you just give your best advice to those who want to become forensic scientists and what they should look for when they're choosing a school to study at?
Sure, yeah, sure, absolutely. So the advice I usually get for students that email me or come to my office and ask for an appointment, obviously the important major to focus on, you have to major in one of the natural or physical sciences. Whether that's biology, chemistry, biochemistry, or one of the related sciences. I get so many students that come and they've gone through an undergraduate program in, say, criminal justice, and they tell me, oh, can I just make up those courses? I mean, that's not going to work because the academic requirement for an entry-level position as a forensic scientist is that minimum degree in science. And it's only going to get, obviously, more rigorous as far as the science is concerned. Some call me and say, I want to become a forensic scientist, but I don't like, taking anything related to oenology, and that's not going to work either. So definitely majoring in that science. And, you know, the other thing that, there's nothing more discouraging than when our students go through the program, they do remarkably well, outstanding students, but they don't actually clear background. So, I mean, the advice is make good lifestyle choices. Things like not living beyond your means, being mindful of credit card debt, avoiding drug use, common sense when it comes to alcohol, anything your parent would tell you, basically, I suppose. But again, things like, you know, nowadays, of course, social media, you know, it's really important to use discretion as to what information you post, because background investigators will go and dig deeply into your lifestyle. So in addition to being an outstanding student, you have to make those good decisions. In selecting a school, of course, it should be lab-based, there should be research opportunities, and most importantly, working with a lab. As far as an internship program, that's the biggest predictor of getting hired, is having your foot in the door in that internship program.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure, and we look forward to talking to you again down the road. Thank you for giving us your time.
We've learned a lot here. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate your time. Bye-bye now.
Thanks.